From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in November of 2014, the midterm elections. Across the country, Get Out the Vote efforts targeted different areas, different sections of our vast American community. And there were significant questions about the Latino voter turnout. After all, Latinos had helped carry Barack Obama to the White House in 2008 and 2012. What about the midterm? Would they turn out in big numbers? Democrats hoped so. Republicans were working to win more of the Latino vote. Well, here's the story. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 46% of eligible white voters cast ballots in that election. 41% of African-American eligible voters did the same. Just 27% of Latino eligible voters got to the polls. Today on Connections, we're spending these 2 hours previewing the Upstate Latino Summit. The event happens next Wednesday at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center, and it aims to bring together key leaders from all of upstate New York. They're going to discuss education, health, business, immigration, and politics, government. My colleague Michelle Faust and I will navigate those subjects during these 2 hours on Connections. And I open with the story of Latino voter turnout because it's tied to the issue of Latinos in government and Latino participation in American politics. Michelle Faust, first of all, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. And our guest for this half hour in studio with us is Armando Musa. He's with the government team of La Cumbre. Nice to have you, Armando.
Great to be here, Evan.
Mercedes Vasquez is back. She is born and raised in Rochester. Now, her business, her work is something called Pretty Girl Productions, but you're also the president of the New York Referral Center for Immigration Rights. Nice to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And on the phone with us is Assemblyman Peter Lopez. Assemblyman, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
I started with that question on participation. And Armando, let me start with you. Those numbers, 46% of white turnout, 41% of African-American, 27% of Latinos. I walked in the door and you said that doesn't surprise you. That's a national number, but even locally, that wouldn't surprise you?
It wouldn't surprise me at all. In fact, one of the things that I learned earlier this year and really shocked me was that in Monroe County, Monroe County has 60,000 Latinos. Of those 60,000, 16,000 are actually registered to vote. But you know how many actually have ever voted? Less than 5,000. So that leaves 11,000 Latinos who are registered to vote and just don't vote. And that's a tremendous problem for the community.
How do we start fixing that?
We need to get Latinos more engaged. I'm a member of, like you mentioned, La Cumbre's government team. And one of the things that we've focused on this year has been civic engagement. We've put together a workshop, and we've had one in July, August, and we have one coming up on September 19th. And the goal is to educate folks on local government and to let them know that their voice matters and their vote really counts. And we've tried to do it in a very nonpartisan way. We're not there to tell folks who to vote for, but just to vote. We want them to vote.
By the way, can you mention to our audience, just sort of lay out what La Cumbre is?
Sure, absolutely. La Cumbre is a forum of members of the greater Rochester area. And it's focused on improving the lives of Hispanics in the areas of education, health, arts and culture, economic development, and government and public safety. So that's La Cumbre in a nutshell.
And coming up on the 19th, again, it's a workshop, but more of the details on that.
Absolutely. The workshop is going to be held at the Anthony Jordan Health Center on Saturday, September 19th, from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. If you're interested, please call 738-6257 to RSVP. And again, we're going to talk about three key areas. We're going to talk about government structure and educate folks on city council, Rochester City School District, kind of legislature, kind of a who's who, voter engagement, and advocacy. We're going to teach folks how if you have a problem, how to get it to the right person in government. Okay. And there'll be a panel discussion with elected officials where you'll have a Q&A and you'll be able to ask questions.
Okay. Michelle Faust, did you want to jump in here?
No, that was part of the conversation that I had on Need to Know last night, and I plan on being at that event.
Okay, that's coming up September 19th. The Mercedes Vasquez, what do you make of those numbers? And in your own sort of your own life and the work that you do, what is it going to take to change that?
Education, certainly getting out there, doing the grassroots effort of educating our folks. Also, what I tell politicians when they ask me, how do we engage Latino community, the information has to be in Spanish. Typically what happens is you'll get mail-outs or you'll get politicians that are attempt to engage the Latino community, and they have that language barrier. So getting out there, ensuring that the information is in Spanish. But going back to what was mentioned earlier, is education is key. If they don't know who the elected or tentative elected officials are going to be, then they're not going to make the effort of going down and voting.
Assemblyman Lopez, what do you make of the question of turnout, and what have you seen in your own work to try to turn out more of this community?
Well, my observation is it boils down to a sense of ownership of our community. So clearly the signal that's being given is that our communities feel alienated. They are not engaged. They're not working to provide the resource, the potential that they have for strengthening the community. They're not being asked or included in a meaningful way. So where they feel they have ownership, that translates into many things: economic development, quality of life, but also civic and political engagement.
To some degree, you can't separate politics from the discussion on turnout and what's going on, especially as we move into a presidential election year. And we're not going to spend the entire half hour or hour just on the presidential candidates. But I think it's important to point out, Mercedes, Republican.
Right.
Our assemblyman on the phone with us, Peter Lopez, is a Republican. And to some degree, I think some view the national political scene of Democrats kind of counting on a Latino vote. And, you know, I know Republicans have been trying to kind of carve into that and have a bit more of a balance there. And yet, you just said, Mercedes, we need materials in Spanish. And Carly Fiorina, who's a Republican candidate who's worked her way upwards in the polls, recently said she's pretty sure that English is the language of the country. And there is no national language in this country. We should point that out.
Does
that surprise you to hear that? You know, Donald Trump said Jeb Bush, well, it's great that he's that he can speak two languages, but really you should speak English when you're in this country.
Right,
I find that inflammatory.
You know, it's not surprising to hear that. Often we make assumptions about politicians, besides the fact of being politically correct, but also being aware of who your demographic is. If you're targeting the Latino community, one should try to really look at how do we really penetrate that market. And to be effective, you really need to sort of cater to them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not saying that one should just be, you know, English only or specific about that.
Yeah, and I have no problem with candidates talking to Latinos in Spanish. I mean, if a question is asked in Spanish, it's perfectly legitimate to answer in Spanish. And I know that Jeb Bush is going to do a real push to get the Latino vote, and I have a feeling he's going to be successful.
Well, if he becomes the nominee, it'll be I would think it would be a totally different election.
Absolutely.
Because obviously he is married to someone from this community. He speaks the language. He's not afraid of speaking the language. But right now he's dealing with the primary in which he gets pushed around if he simply answers something in Spanish, which is amazing.
He does have it. But he made it very clear a long time ago. He said if Republicans want to win in November of 2016, the candidate has to be willing to lose the primary to win the general. And that's been his strategy, and it's going to continue to be his strategy. If what people are looking for is a Trump, then Jeb's not the guy. But Republicans are not going to win in November.
But Assemblyman Lopez, you know, somebody pointed out that 8 years ago at this time, Rudy Giuliani was dominating all of the polls. And he ended up with fewer electoral votes than Ron Paul that year. Not Rand Paul, Ron Paul. But I'm curious to know if you find it troubling to hear some of the Republicans, and again, not just Donald Trump, who said Jeb should speak English, you're in this country, but Carly Fiorina thinks there's a national language and there's not. Are you troubled by that?
I can tell you, and again, when you reflect on the district I represent, my district is largely rural and upstate, and probably less than 4% minority, so I'm an anomaly, to be honest, in that district. I'm the only Republican ever, Hispanic, Latino ever elected upstate in the state assembly. And the challenge is that you have a culture historically that has relied on the English language as the common denominator. So part of it is cultural, part of it is historic, part of it is just a function of finding some common denominator that we can communicate with each other by. And that's I wouldn't say sometimes I'm frustrated by it, but I think the premise is when you look at where we've come from as a nation, we've had that perception that people have gravitated towards English language as the language simply to communicate with each other. And there is an issue there if we become too fragmented the issue of effective communication, effective governing, effective community development, no pun intended, can be lost in the translation. So it is a troublesome issue, but I understand where it's coming from. So I think our challenge is, how do we overcome that? How do we communicate effectively? How do we give people a sense of being included, not feeling excluded? And I think if we approach it in that fashion, rather than get into a more polarizing discussion, I think we do better as a community.
Mercedes, you mentioned the reaching out to voters in the Spanish language. Now, I just want some clarity there. It's not necessarily because those voters don't speak English, but they feel more comfortable in the English language. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. The Latino community, and specifically here in Rochester, is a very tight community. We have organizations like Ibero that are really fundamental in reaching in that population. Ibero having the summit is just, again, reaching out to the community, educating our population on key elements, politics and things that are, again, it's a tight community, it's a close community, and I think the grassroots effort is really the approach with our community.
I think we will probably all agree on this, that it should not be political to celebrate someone being bilingual or trilingual. We love polyglots. I'm sitting next to one. Michelle Faust, my colleague, is not only a polyglot, she's taught in how many different languages have you taught in? Three?
I speak three languages fluently,
and you've
studied several others.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's really remarkable. We should celebrate that, and that should not be a political statement. There is a part of me that worries there's a little bit of xenophobia sort of leaking in here, but I've said on this program, when we've had Republican roundtables, where are we going in the primaries? I don't think Trump's going to be the person at the end, and if it's Jeb Bush, I do think it's going to be fascinating to watch what happens in the Latino vote. But that's not the only big story here when it comes to politics. And in this half hour, if you're just joining us, we're previewing the Upstate Latino Summit that's coming up this coming Wednesday at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. And throughout these 2 hours, Michelle Faust and I are navigating many of the issues that are prominent to Latino voters, Latino citizens, et cetera. And so we're going to be getting to healthcare and education and business later on. We're starting this hour with politics and immigration. If you want to join the conversation, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. My guests are Armando Musa from La Cumbre, Mercedes Vazquez, who is the president of New York Referral Center for Immigration Rights, and on the line with us is Assemblyman Peter Lopez. And Assemblyman Lopez, let me ask you just about issues that voters express to you. It's interesting, whenever we talk about, sort of Latino issues, we have some listeners who say, no, there's no Latino issues or African-American issues, there's American issues. And others say, there are, and certain communities are really, sort of motivated by different things. How would you answer the question of what your community and what voters are saying to you really matters this year, next year, and beyond?
Well, ultimately, the common denominator, and this is the piece that transcends race, gender, are issues of education and personal empowerment. So the prospect of helping people reach their full potential, it resonates for my district. And again, my district, largely rural, much of it is in the Appalachian Regional Commission territory. So if you can imagine mountainous regions, small towns, villages, farms, but people in pervasive poverty, lack of educational attainment, lack of job opportunities. So those overarch. Beyond that, certainly, as I'm the only member, the only Republican member of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, which is primarily downstate driven, some upstate metropolitan centers, of course, in Rochester being one of them. And there are issues there that are unique to our minority populations. And so we have to be sensitive to those, but recognize that in some cases there are common strains with education and job creation, in particular job skill training.
Michelle Faust?
I thought it was interesting, talking about, there are issues that touch all communities, but then there are some things that are more specific to certain communities. But Latino community is not one community, but a very diverse set of communities with ethnic, economic, all kinds of differences. People who prefer Spanish, people who prefer English, people who are fully bilingual. Can we expect politics to be able to address issues to of relevance to everyone in this entire group? I mean, is that even possible? What do you think, Armando?
I think we have to believe in politics' ability to do that. I mean, yeah, there are different segments within the Hispanic community, but in the end, we're one community. The Hispanic issues are really not that different from Anglo issues, and in some ways, I think it's kind of productive for us to segment ourselves so much. I do believe in the power of politics to address issues across the board.
I agree. And if I may, I'd like to give you a perfect example. As a member of the Black Puerto Rican Caucus, we had an issue with upstate dairy farmers in my region struggling, family farms struggling. And we had legislation that had passed in the Senate, which reflects more of an upstate view and philosophy. But the bill that was providing support was not making it in the Assembly. It was languishing. So I put together a coalition, and I met with Darrell Towns, who then was the chairman of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus. I had Jose Rivera from the Bronx, myself, Bill McGee from Central New York, Madison County, who's the chairman of the Ag Committee, and also some upstate dairy farmers, Farm Bureau, myself. And we spoke about the issue of local food, of the importance of family farms, and that issue translated across the geography, across the cultures, across the urban-rural divide. And when we finished, Jose Rivera, who I love, said, "Pete, I support your position. I will lobby the governor." Darrell Towns said, "Pete, I went to an agricultural school in the South. We support your position." 3 days later, we passed that bill. And so there is an opportunity. The challenge, and this is how I do my job, I look for what are the things that unite us? What are the things that pull us together? What are the common goals and the common priorities? That is the language, regardless of whether it's Spanish or English or some other language. When we can focus on what is the language of the issue and the importance to the families and to the communities, that's where the politics can be very productive and very powerful, very real.
Let me get to the phones, because on that question of bilingualism, Don in Brighton wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, well, basically, I come from a family where three generations were bilingual and I'm semi-bilingual. But they came, my ancestors came at a point where they really became truly bilingual because no one catered to the fact that their first language was German. And therefore, they all became quite successful. And I married a lady who was an immigrant, came here at the age of 16, and had to learn English along with her siblings. Now, their family kept up German at home, but did not allow anyone in the family to speak German when they had company or on the street. And they all learned English very fluently, enough so that my wife went to college, her sister got a PhD, the brother is a surgeon. And my point is, if we don't push people to become fluent in English by letting them go to school in a bilingual education rather than immersion, they will not, we're handicapping them. You know, my wife's family and my parents learned English by total immersion going to school.
Thanks for the phone call, Don. Let me let the panel weigh in here. I'll start with Armando. Go ahead, Armando.
Yeah, I think I agree with a lot of what he said. I think immersion is key. I think, you know, if you come to this country, you should learn English. And the best way to do that is to be immersed in the English language. That being said, I think learning a second language or a third or fourth language is very important for us to be competitive as a nation and internationally, given the global nature of business, et cetera. So yeah, immersion, but also focus on foreign languages.
Mercedes?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with some of the points he mentioned as well. I think that the majority of the Latinos that come into the United States have a goal of learning and speaking English fluently. Certainly, it benefits to navigate through different segments of their lives. If you want to go back to just the political aspect of it, if you want to be effective, and if you want to effectively communicate with a population, the information should be in dual language.
Assemblyman Lopez?
Yeah, I lived it. So I was born in Miami in 1961. And my father's part of the Puerto Rican wave coming in to find employment for his eight brothers and sisters. he came from subsistence agriculture on the island. When he moved to Schenectady, he married Barbara May Skiff. This was around the time of Martin Luther King. The whole premise of one, the married relationship was frowned upon, so there was a social issue to begin with. But the language piece was also a barrier. And so my father, we celebrated the culture, we celebrated the language, the music, family, our traditions and culture. But he made it very clear that English was to be the language spoken outside of the household. And so, again, for the reason you heard from the listener, the advantage is being able to understand culture, understand language, but also being able to communicate effectively and be able to move forward in society. And it's been a challenge, but effectively we do need to find something that some common denominator, some way of communicating. So honor culture, but also have some common format for communicating. And that's irrespective of whether it's English or Spanish. Over time, who knows, maybe 100 years from now, the way the population is growing, maybe the word, the language becomes Spanish. Who knows? It's very possible.
We are talking about many of the issues that will be in play with the Upstate Latino Summit, which comes to Rochester this coming Wednesday. And a few more minutes on the subject of Latinos in government, and then we're going to talk immigration after the break. And Kelly writes to us and says, I appreciate the fact that your panel does have some political diversity. Not all Latinos are Democrats, but is there a diverse set of opinions about the issue of immigration that has become, unfortunately, pretty ugly on the political scene? That's from Kelly. Mercedes, I'll start with you. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think that, and more so here in Rochester, the majority of the Latino community consists of Puerto Ricans, which are automatic American citizens. But we do have a growing population of Dominicans and Cubans, which we need to also address. As far as, again, I do believe that there is a diverse set of opinions, and it really depends on who's actually coming from. A Cuban who's been here in several generations in. But we have to address that segment that is currently here and contributing to our society.
Armando Musa?
No, I would agree with that. I think immigration reform is imperative. I think our country needs immigration reform, needs comprehensive immigration reform, and it should be an immigration reform focused on economic growth and development. Right now, we have a system where people are allowed to immigrate to the U.S. based on family ties. And oftentimes, folks who come are not the most productive folks. So if we really look for the best and brightest in other countries who want to contribute, and we give them preference to come, I think that would be a smart thing to do.
And Assemblyman Lopez, let me ask you this in a bit of a different way here. My view on the question of what you do about immigration, undocumented workers, it's complex, and I suspect every community, every sort of individual community within our great American community might have internal debates, even the Latino community, which is healthy. What concerns me a little bit is some of what is driving the debate in the primaries does seem a little heated to the point of almost cartoonish, you know, that we're going to send 11 million people out of here, we're going to deport 11 million people, we're going to send children home. It has felt over the top, and I understand that's where primaries go, and then you sort of tack back, which is again why I do suspect a candidate like Jeb Bush is, you know, if he could survive a primary, would be much better position. But I don't know. How do you feel about some of the language you're hearing on the political scene with this?
It's intense and rhetorical, and you nailed it. In a primary, in the stage we're in, the extremes dictate. So the challenge has been, and this is where I gravitate. I try to be independent in thought, and I try to find the common denominator. So people have called me, I'm conservative, I feel, but people have called me a thoughtful moderate. The truth lies in between. And you know, I go back to the writings of Teddy Roosevelt, who had some very insightful comments. The biggest observation he had, which I share, is that we have to get away from perpetuating a class, a shadow class, a class of second-rate citizens by denying that they're here and not giving them an opportunity to be full citizens. And what's happened, and this is where it becomes very emotional, we find because of those emotional ties and the desire to lift these people up, we have legislation aimed at giving individuals who are not documented, who are not legally here, rights and privileges that border on being a citizen without being a citizen. That's a very dangerous direction and really destructive, in my opinion. So give people a path. Let them find a way to become a citizen. Let them work from where they are and bring them out of the shadows. And that's been my constant refrain on any number of bills that have come before us in the legislature, from addressing driver's license IDs to tuition assistance. We need to find a path that allows people to become citizens and come out of the shadows and let their children play with our children. That's really the spirit of what Teddy Roosevelt wrote about in the 1900s.
And Assemblyman Lopez, you are a Republican. If your party nominates someone who wants to deport 11 million people and build a wall, will you be disappointed in your own party?
I'm disappointed when people... My answer would be yes, because I'm disappointed when people lose track, when they treat people as objects and not subjects. And that happens too often. And that happens in business. That happens in school playgrounds. That happens in politics. So our goal has to be to remember who we are as a community. We are a nation of immigrants. We are a nation, but we're also a nation of laws and a nation of order. So we have to respect our traditions and our roots, but not forsake our humanity in the process. And so I would be disappointed. You know, I hear Mr. Trump speak, and it's easy to, for any candidate, and not just Mr. Trump, to list concerns and list issues. And it's easy to be strident in these primary settings, but we really need to be thoughtful about our own humanity and what we want for our society and our world. What message are we sending?
All right, some final thoughts before we shift the conversation and take a short break here. Armando Musa has been here from La Cumbre. And once again, coming up on September 19th, you've got a workshop. Let our audience know how they can participate, Armando.
Okay, if you're interested in participating, please call 738-6257. The workshop's going to be Saturday, September 19th from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Anthony Jordan Health Center on 82 Holland Street in Rochester.
Are you an optimist that participation and engagement is growing?
I absolutely am. We've already held two workshops. They've been a success. We've gotten new folks to register to vote. Like I said, we don't care who you vote for. We just want you to vote.
Yeah, I think you're doing important work, and I do appreciate you being here. Mercedes Vasquez, some final thoughts on you. You were smiling, and you said you were kind of indicating you're an optimist, too. You think the tide will change eventually in Latino participation.
You know, I do think so. And again, with summits of this nature, I think that's going to do it. But, I mean, just to get back on some of the items that were addressed earlier.
Yeah.
As far as the political scene and that immigration is such a big topic, I'm almost happy that we're in this position because it is bringing up major issues that for so long wasn't addressed. I think good can come out of all of this. The whole notion of moving everyone out or pushing all the immigrants out is a bit ridiculous, considering the cost that it's going to cost our country billions of dollars that we don't have. But again, it's going to bring up major topics, and it's bringing awareness to it. So,
thank you for being here, Mercedes. Mercedes, the president of the New York Referral Center for Immigration Rights. Nice to have a conversation with you.
Thank you for having me.
Armando Musa from La Cumbre. Thank you, Armando.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And also on the line with us has been Assemblyman Peter Lopez. And Assemblyman Lopez, thank you for your time as well this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Short break, and we'll talk a little bit more deeply about immigration when we come right back here. We're previewing the Upstate Latino Summit, both hours on Connections today. Coming up in our second hour, we continue our preview of the Upstate Latino Summit and take a look at issues related to business, healthcare, and education. Michelle Faust joins me with your comments and phone calls tied in as well. The Upstate Latino Summit conversation and preview next hour, right here on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Plant Designs, offering live and silk indoor plants and providing plant maintenance services to homes and businesses since 1975. Plant Designs, landscaping the great indoors. PlantDesigns.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My colleague Michelle Faust is joining me these 2 hours as we preview the Upstate Latino Summit. And we'll take more of your questions and comments if you want to join the program. We've already had some phone calls and comments online. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. This year especially, but really every year, you can't take immigration out of politics. We open with a conversation on Latinos in government and politics and engagement, and now we're going to turn more forcefully to the question of immigration, and I'll let Michelle introduce our next two guests.
Well, over the phone right now, we have Rafael Collazo. He is part of the National Council of La Raza. Welcome, Rafael.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here with you all today.
And in the studio with us, we have Luis Torres from Worker Justice and Power, and I'll let you both explain what your organizations do. Rafael, can you talk to us a little bit about, for people who've never heard of it, what is the National Council of La Raza?
Sure. So NCLR is generally regarded as the largest national Hispanic civil rights organization in the country, so somewhat analogous to your listeners about the historical presence of an institution like the NAACP. In the African-American community, we've served traditionally a similar role in our 40-year history, providing advocacy on behalf of the Latino community nationally.
In that first half hour, we were talking a lot about some of the rhetoric coming out of the primary season among the Republican candidates. And I just wanted you to kind of give us an idea of how is the National Council of La Raza responding to some of the ideas, especially when it comes to immigration coming from the Republican candidates, especially Donald Trump.
Sure. Well, first of all, I got to hear the last part of the first part of this conversation, and I really greatly value the Assemblyman, Peter Lopez, and a great personal friend and great local leader, Mercedes Vasquez's comments. I would take what Evan mentioned, referred to as cartoonish language, and really couch it in what it is, which is hate speech, particularly with the platform that Trump and other candidates have. This speech is no less, not only diverting what is really a serious debate, but really putting tens of millions of Latinos in harm's way. We're already seeing hate crimes that assailants are literally saying is being inspired. The homeless man being beat up, assaulted in Boston, a shooting in Indiana very recently to a young child just walking down the street because he was Hispanic. This is an incredibly dangerous conversation, as well as really mucking up what should be a thoughtful conversation about how do we handle from a security and economic perspective the fate of immigrants coming to this country.
Rafael, let me just add to that. For a while when Donald Trump declared earlier this summer, there was this attitude that, well, he's kind of a joke, he's a narcissist, but he's not going to gain much traction. And Matt Taibbi in the Rolling Stone recently wrote a piece after the Boston incident where he said, this is not funny anymore. For people who thought, oh, he's silly, he's a narcissist, he says inflammatory things, he doesn't care what he says. Matt Taibbi says, it's not funny anymore. If you were laughing before, it's serious now, and it sounds like you agree with that, Rafael.
Absolutely, and in our analysis of the candidate Trump's immigration plan, which he released some time ago, and not only is it prohibitively expensive and incredibly impractical, it's deeply unconstitutional. Some of his policies that relate to rescinding people's citizenship. I mean, this really is so out of the pale as it relates to a real thoughtful policy conversation in this country. It's just really sad, and it is not funny because, again, we're seeing hate crimes taking place, and who knows what else will come out of this. I mean, we see the human toll of what's happening internationally with the Syrian refugees, and we're seeing some of the, quite honestly, depending on the country they're walking in, entering, them being attacked. And so this really goes to when leadership stokes fears and blames the most vulnerable in our society, these are the kind of things that can happen, and it's very dangerous.
Well, let's talk a little bit more then with our in-studio guests then. Luis, why don't you tell us more about what Worker Justice is and kind of give us a sense more for your mission?
So the Worker Justice Center is a legal service organization that works specifically with low-income workers. But at the same time, as they provide legal services to low-income workers, they also understand that there's a difference between what's legal and what is just. So they've housed me a worker center, which is called POWER, People Organizing for Worker Empowerment and Respect, to help people come together, learn about their rights, and as a community, act on them. So sometimes, for example, one of the issues that we just faced was discrimination at work based on nation of origin. It wasn't a Latino, it was an Algerian, but it's still within the, so we need to make sure that we, when we talk about the immigration discussion, we don't only focus that on the Latino community.
Sure, sure. It just happens that right now in the political scene, it's supercharged in that way. But I think even in the Syrian refugee crisis, you've got people who just, the language is almost that, you know, some people seem to want to build a wall. Was it Scott Walker who mentioned maybe a Canadian border, you know, maybe a Canadian wall? It is, I don't mean to laugh. It's just, it's really a kind of a remarkable setting right now on some of the language. So, but I take the point that you're making.
And Mr. Collazo can talk more about the national dialogue, but it's also important to go back to the local. You know, right now in Rochester, in our upstate communities, this is something that you don't need to go to Arizona to talk about this. You know, talk about the relationship that the Mexicans, people who are usually associated as Latinos, are facing, people from Central America, are facing in terms of their relationship with the police, their relationship with the relationship between the police, local police, and border patrol. So these things is, you can definitely talk about it in the national level, but it has also a very solid local level.
Okay. In just a moment, we're going to go back to the phones. I see the phones ringing, but Michelle, go ahead.
I just wanted to follow up on the conversation with Mr. Collazo. We were talking about rhetoric and some of the dialogue happening at the national level. One of the words that was thrown around and was used by more than one candidate when we're talking about the Republican primary conversation was the term anchor babies. And that was used both by Donald Trump and Jeb Bush. And I just wanted to know what was the thoughts coming from the National Council of La Raza on this term?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's nothing short of despicable to use that kind of terminology to refer to a disparaging language to children, small children, to babies, you know, and to speak to the, just to reemphasize this point is that when, you know, Latinos at this point, when the tone of this conversation goes to hate speech, Latinos are all under attack, regardless of our citizenship status. You know, the gentleman again in Boston that was beat up. Who knows what his, you know, the assailants had no idea what his personal history was. And so when we use this kind of language, where we're literally insulting and denigrating babies, small children, it really takes away the humanity of literally tens of millions of Americans and members of our community.
And I don't want to move this again into analyzing every political candidate on the national stage, but we did talk to some members of the Republican Party in the first half hour who made a couple of points that, number one, you know, you shouldn't look at Latinos as a monolithic block that would only vote Democrat, and number two, that there is some optimism that Jeb Bush is much more of a moderate figure who is sort of thoughtful about this community, speaks the language pretty well, is not afraid to do that, and I wonder, Rafael, if you feel the same way.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, that remains to be seen. I mean, he obviously, because of his personal history and his time as governor of the state of Florida, he obviously is fairly familiar with the Latino community, is engaged with Latino community, is literally has Hispanic family members. But he was the person that sort of stumbled upon this term and made it a part of his anchor babies, if you will, and made it a part of his conversation for quite, you know, for many weeks in the campaign. And so, you know, he will ultimately have to prove his connection and his that his policies resonate with the Latino community. But our focus is, regardless of the candidates or the parties, you know, we want elected officials on both sides of the aisle that get away from this kind of language, treat our community with respect, and proactively work on bipartisan solutions to our issues, whether it's immigration or all kinds of issues. I mean, Latinos are feeling the brunt of the ongoing economic issues that we're dealing with, whether it's wages, job access, You know, education, healthcare. There's all kinds of issues that we're concerned about, and we need people on both sides of the aisle that will speak to them directly and treat our community with respect.
Let me get to the phones, and this is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John. John,
hey,
yeah,
Evan.
Yeah, very good.
I just wanted to touch base. I support Donald Trump a little bit on what he says. In that, obviously, when he makes some of these insults, which he's off the top of his head, I think it's not right at all. But I got to say, he's right in that illegal aliens, illegal immigrants, are just that. They're violating federal law, and this is promoting a lawless society. And this is what I think Trump is getting a following on, because people are afraid to talk about it. Cesar Chavez used to form, when he was United Farm Workers head, and he founded that union back in the 50s and 60s, I guess he was prominent. He actually went to the border with squads of union people to physically confront these illegal aliens. And what really irks me, the so-called labor leaders of the major unions in this country are warming up to illegal aliens, trying to get legalization, which is going to hurt the membership. If you put more supply, especially in a lower-end job market, it's going to hurt actual citizens of the United States, legal citizens. And I know Latinos that are legal that are outraged over this lawlessness from these illegal aliens and the people that promote it.
Okay, well, stay on the line, John, and we'll start with, why don't we start with Luis Torres? Go ahead, Luis.
So first, the Cesar Chavez, I think that's only half the story. When you see his organizing history, you saw his turnaround when he saw that to organize workers, he had to organize all workers, not only the ones that were here with documents. Second, I believe that this discussion is one of marginalization through the legal laws. So the lack of ability for our federal government to really address the communities that are here, the people who are in our schools, the people who are becoming part of our community, and they're shying away from that, that is what's providing that kind of gap. And it's not only about who has the documents or not. And third, in terms of labor laws and organizing, we're seeing that people understand that when we don't stand together as workers, people who have documents or undocumented, they're going to use the ones without documents against the ones with documents. And we need to organize a new labor movement where we are able to bring everybody up.
Rafael?
Yeah, no, and to that degree, you know, there's probably more agreement with the gentleman that called with the direction we want to go to the Humane Imagine. I mean, look, there's, you know, 2 years ago when the Senate passed the bipartisan bill, NCLR, even though we had trepidations about some of the issues, you know, the details of the bill, ultimately we were supportive of it because we do want to address security of our country. We want everyone to come out of the shadows so we can have a proper flow of fair labor practices, of security practices, of access to services. You know, the immigration is at a net zero at this point, partially because of the international economy and partially because of increased border security and deportation. So there's virtually no one that's advocating for quote unquote open borders or just the kinds of the tone of which that the gentleman's referring to. But absolutely, we don't want anyone in the labor market to be undercut. We want fair competition. We want everyone to have the same kind of access to fair labor practices. And these are the kinds of issues that are very complicated, but we need a bipartisan federal solution and not demonization or just stagnation. I mean, we've been calling on this NCLR for over two decades for this to be addressed, referring to some of the issues the gentleman brought up, and we definitely need action to come up with a solution that also fairly deals with the 11 million people that are here contributing to our country overwhelmingly, but, you know, are in the situation that, you know, that we have to grapple with.
Check out NPR today and NPR.org. You'll find the story. Mass deportation may sound unlikely, but it's happened before. And they tell the story just in briefly here. Presidential candidate Donald Trump's proposal to deport all 11 million immigrants living in the country illegally, along with their U.S.-born children, might sound far-fetched. But in the 1930s and 40s, up to 2 million Mexicans and Mexican-Americans were deported or expelled from cities and towns across the U.S. and shipped to Mexico. So, again, just building on some of that. If you want to learn the history, that story today. Go ahead, Michelle.
And one thing I just want to point out is that many of those people were U.S. citizens were deported.
Exactly right. Some were Mexicans. Some were U.S. citizens. So we've been talking this hour about the idea that it's sort of cartoonish. It's not going to happen. But it's not impossible. We've done stuff like this before. And it's just something to sort of keep in mind, that history.
Well, if I could just add, we are, to a smaller degree, we're already doing it in the sense that President Obama's administration has deported more people than any of the past presidents combined. And so, you know, there is a large-scale, relatively speaking, amount of deportations taking place. Now, part of the human impact of that is that those adults that are being deported, many of their U.S.-born American children remain. And so whether it's extended family or, frankly, our government and our society has to take care of these children. So what's the more logical solution to this? A fair process where people come out of the shadows, make sure they're contributing to our society, in some way pay what would be reasonable penalties for the fact that they initially came to the country undocumented, overwhelmingly because they overstayed a visa, not because of a quote-unquote border crossing, or to split up families, which we're now doing, to cause personal education and, you know, damage to children. And so, you know, these are the issues that we have to balance. And so we propose at NCLR that the more logical solution is to come up with a federal legislation that addresses, reasonable penalties, satisfies the border enforcement issues that may remain, but that keeps families together, keeps children that had nothing to do with their parents' decisions, provide them and are very American in the reality of their lives, give them the opportunity to have the education, economic opportunities that all children, frankly, deserve, but particularly children that are part of our society.
I just wanted to direct the conversation, a question that I had for you, Luis. When at the New York State level, what is it that our legislators could be doing to be helping the people who you work with here in our state? I know that the conversation about the DREAM Act has gone on more than one legislative session and has not passed yet. And also the conversation about having some sort of a license for people who are not necessarily in the country legally.
Well, straight out locally, if we're talking about Latinos and Rochester, you know, I think that the county, executive county, is going to be a good conversation they're going to have, because in terms of childcare, Latinos are going to be very affected by the decisions that the next executive person makes for childcare. In terms of, it is a world of difference. You know, we live in two states, right? We live in New York City and we live in upstate New York. And the experiences that we're seeing are so different. You know, when right now we've seen movements in the city to bring us in out of the shadows with documentations, opportunity for people to have ID cards, to be able to have access to basic resources. But in that discussion for the upstate New York is such a hard discussion to have. So we definitely need the leadership of everybody in the state government to be able to kind of put us back into the same state, in a sense.
All right, some final thoughts then from you, Rafael. Rafael Collazo, some final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with on the subjects of immigration and how they can read more about what your organization is doing and some of what you'd like to see happen.
Absolutely. So they can definitely just check out our website, nclr.org, for information about the kind of advocacy and policy recommendations we have as it relates to moving forward on the federal level, and as well as I just really just wanted to note, we're really proud. I'll be participating in the Upstate Latino Summit next week, and really proud of the Ibero Action League and Hilda Escher and who's one of our local affiliate organizations through our network. So just really proud to be a part of this, these important conversations. And again, last thing, Latinos Care, there's a wide range of issues that we're concerned about, from various economic issues related to workforce development, access to work, to education, health care. You know, we're very concerned about the economic status of the island of Puerto Rico, which is something that resonates with our local community in Rochester, and frankly, it's part of the new migration of Puerto Ricans coming from the island. So, you know, there's lots of issues that we need to get engaged in, and we look forward to working with our local Rochester community on moving forward.
Rafael Collazo from La Raza. Thank you so much, Rafael.
Oh, no, thank you.
And Luis Torres, Worker Justice. How do they get in touch with you? 10 seconds.
WJCNY.org. WJCNY.org.
Thank you so much for your time as well. All right, short break, and we continue our preview of the Upstate Latino Summit that's coming this Wednesday. It's next hour on Connections.